Holy crap, man. Did you see this? Not only are they going to have new NATO exercises, they're already having new NATO exercises. They're going to have NATO exercises in Ukraine. In Ukraine. The Rapid Trident exercise will take place on September 13th through 26th. Near Lviv, or Lviv, or however you like to say it, and will include soldiers from Germany, the UK, Spain, Poland, and Norway. Oh, man. I saw Rasmussen on, actually, I was on the phone, and there, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, he's the Secretary General of NATO, which, why does NATO have its own independent leadership? Is there just a bunch of job holders? If anything, it should just be America and, you know, our ambassadors coordinate with the other NATO countries, whatever. Anyway, shouldn't be NATO at all. But anyway, so he's got him and all of his bureaucrats have their own interests in keeping their jobs and finding excuses to continue existing and so forth. And so that's a problem. But so I saw him on CNN. And this part of the interview was over, and the lady wasn't protesting or asking, are you sure, or anything. She was just going on to the next question, but at the bottom of the screen, it said, NATO exercises in Ukraine. And I thought, no. Somebody whose DVR works, verify that for me. Is that what they really just said? What the hell? And then Eric Garris sent me this link to the Wall Street Journal. NATO troops to take part in military exercises in Ukraine. That's funny. Kinda, in a horrifying kind of way. Because I remember being a little kid and the Soviet Union still existed. And at least for a while there, and certainly on the surface, Reagan had a much more brinksmanship approach to the USSR, a la Ike and Kennedy, compared to the detente approach of Nixon and Ford. And really, I guess Carter really started the hawkishness. Him and Brzezinski started the hawkishness again. But anyway, point being that when I was a little kid, there was a possibility that America and the Soviet Union were going to get into a nuclear war. And, you know, I was a little kid, so I was probably not very good at figuring out what exactly were the risks. My parents explained to me that both sides have a severe interest in not going to war, so probably you don't have to worry about it. And if you do have to worry about it, you won't have to worry about it for very long. So don't worry about it. All right. But here's the thing of that, though. Communism was over. The Soviet Union basically disbanded in 1989. I mean, 1989 through 91, and the formal end of the Soviet Union was on Christmas Day, 1991. But, whatever, anyway, two-year run. That was the fall of communism. And that was the fall of the last slightest excuse, shadow of an excuse, for this government or that one to maintain their nuclear weapons arsenals. And now, here we are, 25 years later, 25 years later, we still got our nukes. The Warsaw Pact is gone. Seriously, go look at a map and compare the USSR to the Russian Federation. I think you'll see what I mean. It's gone. But NATO is still here, and NATO is now right up to Russia's border, and of course that's a big part of this fight in Ukraine, and why the Russians refuse to let Ukraine go when America tried to run off with it is because the Americans have said in the past they support bringing Ukraine into NATO, not just into the EU, but into the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. As Putin put it, and I'm not saying this is, you know, libertarian or anything, but I'm saying it's pretty damned obvious. Putin said, you know, I was trying to imagine, he was being kind of coy, you understand. I was trying to imagine going down to Sevastopol, or however you properly pronounce it, the the military base, the naval base down there in the Crimean Peninsula. And he said, I was trying to imagine going down there to visit our friends in NATO. And I thought, you know, that just really doesn't seem right, that we would go to Crimea to visit the naval base of our good friends over there in the NATO alliance. That seemed right to you? Yeah, no, me either. And so I decided, screw that. That was basically what he said. Pretty predictable, pretty obvious response, because it's a war guarantee. NATO membership is a war guarantee. And now here, Ukraine is not even anything like an associate deputy assistant member of NATO or nothing, and still they're going to have NATO exercises in Ukraine. At least according to the Wall Street Journal, it won't include Americans, but Americans are already there a little bit at least, aren't they? I don't know if they'll be part of those exercises or not. Anyway. Also, of course, officials, NATO will create a spearhead rapid reaction force aimed at Russia, designed to counter future invasions. Should have scare quotes here, I guess he forgot. Of course, Jason's been doing the best in the world at debunking the so-called Russian invasion of Ukraine that never did happen over the last few weeks. Talk about crying wolf, jeez. News.antiwar.com, officials, NATO will create a spearhead force aimed at Russia. Oh, really? Aimed at doing what? I mean, what are we even talking about? You cannot wage a war with Russia. They have H-bombs. That's the end of the sentence. You cannot have a war with Russia. How about you may not have a war with Russia? They have H-bombs. That's it. Rapid reaction force to do what? In case you have a black and white picture of a few artillery pieces on the wrong side of a supposed line, you're going to do what then? Rush in there and kill Russian soldiers? In case the president of Georgia tries to reinvade South Ossetia and the Russians say no, you're going to send in a rapid reaction force like George W. Bush refused to do in 2008? And what are they even talking about? If Russia runs absolutely roughshod all the way to Kiev, tough. And I have, you know, extended family anyway in Ukraine. I don't want the Russians to invade and conquer Ukraine at all, you know? But if that does happen, sorry. What, Americans are supposed to give up our hometowns in exchange for Lviv and Kiev and Odessa? In exchange for Donetsk and Luhansk, who don't even want to be part of Ukraine? Or at least want, you know, autonomy within it? No. No. You know, to be perfectly blunt about it, if Russia drops their H-bombs on Ukraine, well, that even just proves my point. Why non-intervention is the only way to go. They've got H-bombs. They can deliver them to where you live. So all your AEI tough guy talk. They're real tough guys over there at AEI. And Heritage and all the other kooks and all the right-wing think tanks I follow on Twitter. Yeah, we need to be tough. We need to be strong. We need to have exercises and rapid reaction forces. And H-bombs can kill you guys too. Anyway, I'm burying the lead here. The good news is the Russians are saying they've got a ceasefire. They're working on a ceasefire. They have agreed on the steps toward a ceasefire. Possibly the worst of the danger has passed here. But damn, I'm tired of the goons that happen to live in the center white part of Washington, D.C. deciding for everybody in this country. Making my hometown of Austin, Texas a target for the Russians. Over what? Trying to run off with Robin to their Batman, as it was put by the editor of Foreign Affairs, the Journal of the Council on Foreign Relations. It'd be like if the Russians tried to run off with Canada or Mexico. Regime change them. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs, the first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. So, yeah, we're going to get back to Ukraine in a minute. Ambassador Jack Matlock is going to be on the show. He was the almost last ambassador to the Soviet Union in the George H.W. Bush years. And so we're going to be talking about what's going on here with NATO and this war and the risks and the what have you. Arming Ukraine could lead to nuclear war, says Lech Walesa, the man who destroyed the Soviet Union. Okay, well, that's a little bit of an overstatement, but he was the head of Poland Solidarity, and that's, as you may know, a very big part of the cracking of the authority of the USSR over the Poles and over, you know, a lot of the rest of the Eastern European countries, the Warsaw Pact countries. So, let me see here. That's too long. I'm going to have to read that at the break. All right. Anyway, yeah, so I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, Jack Matlock, talk about messing with the Russians. No good reason. Also, Brian Burghardt is going to be here. And, man, I don't even have his website up here. I need it. I meant to get around to this all damn day today. Brian Burghardt is a guy who is, he has taken it upon himself to try to compile all of the statistics across the country for American civilians, I guess not necessarily citizens, but anyway, civilians killed by police in America. And I read a great interview of him, and got him coming on the show today. Let me see here. Journalist calls for accountability. Fatal Encounters. Here it is. Fatalencounters.org. And it's kind of an open source sort of a project, too, where you, too, can participate. If you happen to know of killings by police in your town that aren't on here, or somebody else's town that aren't on here, then you can participate. And then I believe they have kind of checks and balances for verifying everything and trying to make sure it's all right. And ways to double check and make sure that the story you're thinking of isn't already in there, because you wouldn't want to push somebody else's work out of the way and all that. Anyway, we're going to talk about it with him. But this is the one crime statistic in America that the FBI just doesn't keep. Doesn't it make you wonder if they really do, but it's just super double top secret classified? Or, like, you know, maybe they did once in 1994 or something, and the director saw the number and went, oh my God, we cannot let this get out. Drop it straight into the fire, down the memory hole, and into the flame. I have a feeling we're going to be shocked but not surprised to find out. And I, you know, it's still a work in progress, too. It's not done yet. So the best he's going to be able to give us is ballparks. But we got to talk about this, man. And, you know, I've been seeing more and more. I saw last night there was a tweet. Good morning, America, for whatever reason. They're interviewing a lady who, she got into a conflict with the cops, what, a year or more ago. You might remember the minivan on the side of the road, and the cops attacked her and smashed the windows of the side of the minivan in with their batons, and she took off. Man, you guys are assaulting me, blam. She took off and got away, I guess. And then, you know, later maybe worked it out with a different police jurisdiction or something. I don't know what happened, how she got away without getting her head blown off. But she had a minivan full of little kids. And the cops attacked her like, you know, she may or may not be a member of the Mahdi Army on the road from Najaf. And anyway, for some reason, they interviewed her again today, again this morning on the show about it. I don't know. Maybe she won her lawsuit or something. Maybe she lost it. But the fact that she would be back on Good Morning America at all is an indication that because of Ferguson, especially because of that just almost suspicious level of overreaction by the police in Ferguson. One of them kill an unarmed guy. Some people come out and protest. They come out in with everything they've got. Every bit of armor and machine guns they got. I'm surprised they didn't, you know, bring howitzers out there. Artillery and real tanks. They overreacted so bad. I could almost imagine some, you know, insane Bill of Rights loving extremist, you know, somehow tricked them into doing that just to provoke this response. Because now even comfortable white ladies on Good Morning America are saying that maybe this is a problem. Could it be that we have a problem with police violence in America? I think it's getting through. Now is a perfect time for Brian Burkhart and the people helping him to put together this story. You know, Radley Balco has done a lot of great work compiling the numbers of SWAT raids every year. The ACLU, of course, we interviewed the lady about it. The ACLU had that recent report out about SWAT raids, about how super majorities of uses of SWAT teams in America, more than 70-something percent, maybe it was 80-something percent, super-duper majorities, are just search warrants. Not arrest warrants for violent, armed murderers. Just search warrants, mostly for drugs. But because of Nelson Rockefeller's life, we have the no-knock, which says, well, gee, if we knocked on the door and said, hi, we're police with a search warrant, why, they might flush whatever down the toilet. And then we wouldn't be able to prosecute them. Like they couldn't give you a million years in jail for flushing something down the toilet if they felt like it. Give me a break. They're the slightest bit of powder left on the rim or what have you, please. But anyway, so these special weapons assault teams, which are just special forces units, military special forces units, trained by Navy SEALs and Delta and Rangers and other degrees of special forces on military bases, that the excuse was just for LA-style AK-47-wielding bank robbery hostage situations, turn out to be for you. And I'm afraid to say for me. I don't know if that's happened to me. I'm not breaking any laws, but that's no protection. Anyway, and there's thousands and thousands of these. Thousands and thousands of them. I think 10,000 a year or something. Every few minutes in America, somebody's getting their door kicked in a dynamic Waco-style raid. And they kill somebody every 28 hours. In fact, maybe that's just they kill an unarmed black male. Or maybe sometimes they're armed, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're using aggressive force, you understand. Black men have the right to bear arms, too. Yeah, that's right, they do. Even BB guns that they want to buy at Walmart, they have the right to do that if they want. I mean, apparently they don't, not really, but they should. Of course, a cop killed a black man for trying to buy a BB gun in the Walmart just the other day. But anyway, sorry, I get on a tangent about how much I hate cops, and I just kind of get stuck there. The greatest enemies of peace and liberty in America. Also, Ramzi Baroud is going to be on to talk about the murderous Israelis and their bloodlust and the innocent victims of the Gaza massacre. It's the Scott Horton Show. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Here weekdays from noon to 3 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network, LRN.FM. And of course, the full interview archive, more than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003, can be found at scotthorton.org. Our next guest is, our first guest on the show today is Jack Matlock. He is the second-to-last ambassador to the USSR. And his website is jackmatlock.com. There you can find links to his books, Reagan and Gorbachev, How the Cold War Ended, Autopsy on an Empire, and Superpower Illusions. Welcome back to the show, Jack. How are you doing?
Glad to be with you.
Good. Very happy to have you here. Appreciate you joining us on the show again. There's a lot to talk about. I guess if it's okay with you, I'd like to start with the latest news, which is the Russians are announcing that they have the workings of some kind of peace deal, or at least agreed upon steps toward a ceasefire. And yet Yatsenyuk, which I'm not sure what exactly is his position anymore, but a powerful leader of the Kiev government,
is
kind of throwing
cold
water on that, apparently, and saying he has no trust in Putin's plan. I'm just wondering what you think of all that, or what you know about all that.
Well, first of all, I hope that they do have an agreement, and it doesn't surprise me that maybe the Ukrainians maybe are not totally agreed among themselves. Presumably, President Poroshenko was dealing with Putin. Now, Prime Minister Yatsenyuk is Prime Minister. And one of the problems in the past has been that, you know, Ukrainians are not united on some of these issues. That's a basic problem. Mm-hmm. But let's hope that at least they're making progress toward some agreement and a ceasefire, because the people in the eastern provinces are really hurting. There are hundreds of thousands of refugees, and the fighting has affected many civilians, and it really is important to bring that to an end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm sorry about that. The reason I said I wasn't sure his position anymore is because I knew that they had dissolved the parliament in some kind of maneuver, and I didn't know whether that meant it was pending on who the prime minister was for now.
Well, it may be that he's acting. Yeah. That's right. He resigned at one point. Things got very confused.
Yeah.
But
I'm
essentially, he's acting as prime minister.
I
yes.
See. Yeah. Yats, as Ambassador Newland called him. And now about those refugees, it's according to the United Nations, approximately 750,000 refugees have already fled. And then I guess the numbers of killed are somewhere approximately 2,300 to 2,600. Do you know?
I've heard all those figures. Obviously, I have no way of knowing how accurate they are, but clearly there has been much more there shouldn't be any killing at all. And this is just getting, to be a terrible situation.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, and before we get to NATO, because we have time, but as far as the current situation goes, I read an article in the Kiev Post, which is, I believe, pretty slanted toward Kiev, but they made no bones or secret about the fact that the Kiev government is sending battalions of neo-Nazis to go and fight in the east. These guys call themselves the Ukrainian Social Nationalists instead of the National Socialists. But they all are proud to fly the symbols of the Soviet Union, the Iron Cross, of Nazi Germany, pardon me, the Iron Cross and SS Lightning Bolts and the Wolfsengel, which is that kind of weird N-shaped takeoff on the swastika. This is the government that America is backing there. What's going on?
Well, I think our government and most of our media has ignored this. But the fact is, these are, one can say they're maybe reformed Nazis. They are militant extreme right wing, and not all are Ukrainians. When we talk about Russian intervention, some of these have come over from Poland and Slovakia and other countries bordering on the western provinces of Ukraine. And we mustn't forget that even before the revolution, in February, it was these forces that started taking over government buildings in the west and the center. It didn't start in the east, where there's the fighting now. It started in the west. And, of course, what Russia has been objecting to is that these forces are extremely anti-Russian, and they're simply saying it is unacceptable to have them in effect control of a neighboring country, one that used to be part of our country, and which is their avowed aim is to bring Ukraine into NATO. And the Russian leaders have said for more than a decade, that is a red line. Do not cross it. It will not happen. And we will do whatever necessary to make sure it doesn't happen. And so that's what we're seeing now. And that's why, you know, to continue to think that we're going to deter Russia by threatening action by NATO is, you know, it's simply seen as provocative by the Russians.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, so one thing that's very clear to people who are critics here is that the U.S. and the Europeans have a whole hell of a lot to do with starting this mess, as you kind of referred to there about the use of the Nazis in the coup in February. But, of course, they forced the all-or-nothing deal on the last president in the first place, which may or may not have been meant to be an offer he couldn't accept. I don't know. But then they supported this coup and all of this, and yet the narrative on TV and in the newspapers and from all the government officials is that this is all just, you know, Putin's attempt to recreate the Soviet Union. He's the aggressor here, and there's no such thing as February 2014. You don't need to worry about any of that. This is the Russians have started everything, and it's the Russian-backed separatists who are trying to tear Ukraine apart. And I guess my question for you is the policy in D.C., do you think, made based on what they know the truth is, or is it actually based on their own ridiculous narrative that this is all just, you know, America trying to protect poor little Ukraine from Russian aggression here? Because if they start really making their policy on their own false narrative they're trying to fool us with, then they're going to be making some really severe mistakes, you know?
I really cannot explain some of the reasons for our policy, but I would say that nothing I've ever said is a justification for what the Russians have done. I think they have intervened more directly than anybody else, and I think they've done so in ways that are going to be very costly to them. But I do think that somehow Washington and much of our media has latched on to a narrative which is quite distorted. The fact that they have has acted as a provocation to the Russians. And, you know, I think the fact that Vladimir Putin has raised his approval rating from something like 49% to over 85% among Russians should tell us something. I mean, it's not just Putin. We're getting at really serious, I would say, disaffection of the Russians with much of our post-Cold War policy. And, of course, the big issue for them has been the expansion of NATO to the east and the increasing attempts in their eyes to encircle Russia and bring it to heel. And so they read such things as spreading democracy, as simply using subversive tactics to bring down governments we don't like, and so on. Mm-hmm. So I do have to wonder, you know, what's going on in Washington. Now, the president...
All right, now, I'm sorry, Ambassador, I'll have to interrupt you right there. We have to stop and take this break. But when we get back, everybody, we'll be talking with Ambassador Jack Matlock, the second-to-last ambassador to the Soviet Union under George H.W. Bush, about America's current NATO policy, the upcoming meeting, the Rapid Reaction Force, Ukraine, and the rest in just a minute. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm on the phone with Ambassador Jack Matlock, almost the last ambassador to the Soviet Union. JackMatlock.com is his website. Reagan and Gorbachev, Autopsy on an Empire and Superpower Illusions are his books. And sorry for having to leave you on hold through that break there, Ambassador, but very happy to have you on the show today. And so, I almost can't believe it, but the Wall Street Journal is reporting that NATO, not only are they creating a new rapid reaction force, which they say is to be used in some sort of context against Russia. I don't know exactly what they think they're talking about there, but then also they're going to have exercises, according to the Wall Street Journal, starting on September 13th in Ukraine. I guess whether or not we have a ceasefire by then, they're going to have NATO exercises in Ukraine. What are they talking about? What are they doing? Who's in charge of this thing?
Well, you know, first of all, I don't think a rapid reaction force is necessary for any of our NATO allies. Obviously, we're going to protect them. Russia is not threatening them, but Ukraine is not a member of NATO. What is driving the Russian aggression there, and it is aggression, is the fear that it will be. So having NATO exercises in Ukraine simply exacerbates the problem. In fact, I would say it is not only unwise, it's getting close to insane.
Yeah, it sure seems like it. I'm sorry.
Presumably they do it, in cooperation with the current government, but the current government doesn't represent the whole country, to put it mildly, and is involved in effect in a civil war. And why you bring NATO into that, when the big issue, as far as Russia is concerned, is Ukraine's relationship to NATO, something that is a total red line, I would think it's the height of irresponsibility to plan any sort of joint military exercise within the territory of Ukraine. I mean, if they want to have a rapid reaction force for the Baltic, well, okay, I don't think it's necessary because the Baltic is they are NATO allies, and yes, we are committed to defend them if they are threatened. I do think that acting as if the problem is one of them that can be solved by military force, or that the threat of military force is going to cause Russia to back down. I mean, Russia has almost as many, just about as many nuclear weapons as we do. If being a nuclear power makes you a superpower, they are a superpower. And you do not fiddle with the security of nuclear powers. I mean, if we learned anything during the Cold War, we should have learned that.
Well, it seems like maybe the idea is, well, if we give them a war guarantee, then that'll be our kind of red line that says as long as you're under our nuclear umbrella, the Russians will never mess with you. Only you're saying the Russians are saying over their dead body,
you're not going to do that. And as Putin said, I can occupy Kiev in 2 weeks, which is probably true if there is a real invasion. I mean, of the Russian army, they can defeat Ukraine immediately. And are we going to threaten nuclear weapons over that? I mean, that would be absolutely insane. That sort of reasoning is precisely the sort of reasoning that got Europe involved in the First World War. When you look at all the mistakes, it's hard to believe that the leaders we have today, and in Europe, I must say, with one or two exceptions, they're quite mediocre. we don't have any more the Churchills or that. And some of the others that Europe had in the past. But anyway, to militarize this thing is obviously the opposite of what we need to be doing, because Ukraine is not in NATO. Two-thirds of the Ukrainians didn't want to be in NATO. And, pushing it on the part of those in the West was one of the most divisive things they have done, not only to offend Russia, but to offend much of the rest of the country. This idea of threatening that we will bring them under NATO protection is precisely the thing that is driving the Russians crazy and causing to do things which I think is not in their interest. I don't approve what they're doing, But, you know, this militarizing everything, when they feel that we're using our military superiority in the world to surround them and in effect to create hegemony in the world which doesn't include them, well, you know, they're going to do anything they can to break out of that. And that's what we're seeing. So, you know, I hope we come off that. And I do hope that, you know, they have started moving toward some sort of agreement. Because in the long run, Ukraine will only be able to keep their country unified and developing. They haven't been developing all that well. They're still suffering from their Soviet heritage and the communist heritage. But they're going to be able to do that only if they do it with Russia's acquiescence. Could you imagine if we had a hostile government in Mexico or Canada, how we would react to that? If some major country and started trying to bring them into an anti-American military alliance, would we stop at anything to stop that? Oh, we wouldn't. You know, we know that. And why we don't understand that with Russia, I just don't understand.
Well, you know, I read an interesting article by Peter Hitchens the other day where he said, you know, all this rhetoric about Putin is Stalin or Putin is Hitler and all these comparisons. Hillary Clinton even compared him to Hitler. Hitchens said, well, wait a minute, you know, what if he's the last of the guys before the Russian Hitler? And what if you got your metaphors and analogies all wrong? And really, the fall of the Soviet Union could be compared to the Versailles Treaty, basically. And so right now is when we're supposed to be a good sport about what's happened to the former Soviet Empire instead of rubbing their face in it and making matters worse and worse and worse. When we did this to the Germans after the First World War, it led to the rise of the right-wing fanatics. So are you sure, you know, Putin isn't basically just a Republican compared to the kind of people who might come after him?
Well, you know, I don't like a lot of those analogies because I think the situation is quite different. One thing, we didn't bring down the Soviet Union. They did. And it was the elected leader of Russia that led the breakup of the Soviet Union. We didn't set these boundaries. They did. I mean, the boundaries of Ukraine were set during the Soviet Union, and they're very artificial in some respects. And to treat this as if somehow it was a united country that is being pressed upon by a more powerful neighbor gets a lot of things just plain wrong. The thing is, we ended the Cold War by negotiation, and it was in the interest of both sides. We all won the Cold War. And then communism was defeated by Gorbachev within the Communist Party. We didn't defeat him. He moved the country off communism, and he was the only one who could have done it because he was the leader of the Communist Party who started reforming the country and acting in the country's interest rather than the party's interest. We didn't force that. That was done, and it wouldn't have happened if we hadn't ended the Cold War beforehand. And then the Soviet Union broke up because it had inner tensions, not because there was pressure from abroad. So the breakup of the Soviet Union was not a victory for the West. We didn't even want it to happen the way it happened. And as a matter of fact, George H.W. Bush went to Kiev August 1st, 1991, and advised the Ukrainians and the other non-Russian republics to sign Gorbachev's Union Treaty. We wanted to see them to hold the Soviet Union, other than the three Baltic countries, together in a voluntary union, because he was bringing reform to that country. And actually, it's never been freer than it was that last year of the Soviet Union. So the idea that the breakup of the Soviet Union was a victory for the West or the United States is absolutely wrong. They were reforming. It was not the Soviet Union of old. And the reforms were coming at that point from Moscow, not from Kiev. They were coming from Moscow. And much of the opposition in Kiev was by the Communist Party apparatus that didn't want to give up power. That apparatus was in the eastern part. And Bush also, in that speech, warned the Ukrainians against what he called suicidal nationalism. Okay, you see that suicidal nationalism in these extreme right-wingers who are doing much of the fighting today in Kiev. So people forget all of that if they ever knew it and make all sorts of assumptions which are simply not in accord with what actually happened.
Right. Well, I mean, aside from the fact of trying to keep Ukraine and Belarus in the Soviet Union, which is a whole other interesting story maybe we could talk about sometime. I mean, I think really the point that Hitchens was trying to make that maybe I didn't say very well was that, you know, the West, the Americans and the British and our friends have basically treated the fall of the Soviet Union like a victory since then. And
that's right.
With NATO expansion, we've really rubbed their face in it and humiliated them as much as we can.
That's
and even
right.
as we're talking about, even to the extent of talking about bringing Ukraine and Georgia, which are these absolute red lines where he, you know, I think the point that Hitchens was trying to make was right now we should be really trying to get along, even to a slightly self-sacrificial extent if we need to be friends with the Russians because, you know, things could be much, much worse. Putin really is not Hitler, no matter how many times they say that. But if we really make matters worse and worse, he could be replaced by people to the right of him who are very hardcore nationalists and who might very well like to take back as many republics as they think they can.
That's partly that, but the other side of it is that, quite frankly, when we look at the big problems in the world that really threaten us, look at ISIS, and so on. Look at the health problems that, say, if Ebola gets out, what a tremendous problem we're going to have worldwide, and so on. Now, and organized crime, drugs, all of this stuff. This is worldwide things where we need Russia helping us deal with these things. And to get distracted with what is essentially a local fight and a family fight, which really is a large part of what's happening in Ukraine, and to take sides in that the way we have, is simply distracting us. As I often put it, on these big issues, Russia is either going to be part of the problem or part of the solution. Why don't we act to try to keep them as part of the solution? Right now, we are absolute natural allies in trying to deal with ISIS and, in Syria and Iraq. And yet we're being distracted, and we're almost dealing with it alone when we need and should be getting more Russian support because we get distracted with these other things.
Right. Yeah, we're right on the verge of maybe a final Iran nuclear deal as well, which we need cooperation on that.
We absolutely do. Yeah. We absolutely do. And, you know, let me say that I think, you know, this may seem strange, but we have more interests in common with Iran than many people seem to think. They, too, are against al-Qaeda and those type of extreme Sunnis. And they helped us in Afghanistan very quietly in many ways. They certainly, we did them a great favor in taking out Saddam Hussein, and yet we seem to be unwilling to talk to them about anything but the nuclear issue. I think if we broaden it, we'll find that there are a lot of things that we can deal with, and that would help us deal with the nuclear issue as well. You know, that's another question, but on many of these issues, Russia has, in fact, a bigger stake than we do. They, you know, in both Iran and Iraq, and they're much closer to Russia than they are to us. And our enemies there are the same enemies. And why we can't, find a way to act jointly on some of these things is beyond me.
All right, Ambassador. Well, I've already kept you over time here into the top of the hour
break.
Okay,
thanks very much.
Thank you so much for your time on the show.
Yeah.
I really do appreciate it.
Okay, surely. Bye.
All right, y'all. That's Ambassador Jack Matlock, the second-to-last ambassador to the Soviet Union. His books are Reagan and Gorbachev, Autopsy on an Empire, and Superpower Illusions. His website is jackmatlock.com. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah, I went a few minutes overtime with Ambassador Matlock there, so check the archive at scotthorton.org/interviews later on. You'll be able to hear the end of that. And now, where's my police state section here? Fatalencounters.org is the website, and Brian Burghardt is the journalist who has put it together. It's an attempt. Well, I'll let you explain it. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Brian?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Tell us all about this. What is this project here?
Okay. Well, the idea is that that the federal government does not collect statistics on use of deadly force from law enforcement. I'm focusing on fatal uses of deadly force. I mean, you could look at officer-involved shootings. There's a million different ways to look at it. I'm looking at fatalities. Okay, it's not just guns. It's also cars. It's also batons. It's whatever. Mm-hmm. So the idea is, since the government doesn't create a database, I'm creating a database, and I'm doing it through using public documents and crowdsourcing.
Okay, and then it's interesting, isn't it, that, well, first of all, that I blew it and didn't give you a proper introduction. You're the editor and publisher of the Reno News and Review, and from Reno, Nevada, so that's very important to mention there. But isn't it strange how, I guess I really don't know, but my impression is that the FBI keeps statistics on every single thing about everything except who gets killed by cops and in what numbers.
Your impression is right on, and in fact, they do sort of keep this information. They have this document that is supposedly a list of justifiable homicides, but it's more the appearance of a document. For example, there are 17,985 state and local law enforcement agencies in the United States. So they pulled 700 of them. And their result was there are about 400 a year when anecdotal evidence, like collecting years' worth of data on killed by police on Facebook, shows that it's closer to 1,200 a year.
Yeah. And then, I guess and part of the problem is, we don't have really eras to compare or anything like that, right? Nobody took up this project back in the 70s, did they? So can we say, there's a rate of increase?
They actually did collect information better back in those days.
Okay, so then can you compare, and are things really changing then, do you think?
All right, here's my thing. This database started in March, so really it's only been going for a couple months, and I've only got about 1,300 incidents out of what I expect to be about 17,000.
Right.
So I'm not really drawing any conclusions yet.
Right.
It's just very early in the collection process. Even though it's already huge, it's still very early.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, I wouldn't want you to get ahead of yourself there either.
But I would say the appearance, there's a couple reasons that it appears that it is increasing. Number one, the numbers were so much lower back when they did collect them, but that might have just been the way they collected them back then, and also because since so much of this is crowdsourced, people depend on their memory, and they remember, a couple years back, and they research that. And the internet did not have as wide a use in 2000, which is when I start. So the farther you get, the more spotty the reporting is on the internet.
Right.
So it would naturally have a tendency to creep up with the use of the internet.
You really need like grad students going down and digging through records because, yeah, you're right. I mean, the local CBS affiliate news station's website has been redone 15 times since then. You can't count on them still having stories from back then at all.
Right, and back in those earlier days, memory was expensive. So it's like we'd clean out our archives, you know. Many newspapers and media sources cleaned out their archives. Video was almost impossible. It was so huge. Originally, my original idea, and this is how I did the state of Nevada, was to make public records requests of every state and local law enforcement agency in the United States. That was going to be the crowdsourced part of it. So I did that with Nevada. I sent public records requests, and I got hard copies back for the entire state of Nevada. So Nevada is comprehensive in the database. You can draw conclusions from Nevada all you want.
Well, that's good. So you talk about how it's open source and all that, and you know I don't know whether I'd be if I have the time or if I'd really be useful, but I can think of police shootings here in Austin, Texas, that were unjustified from way back then that may or may not be in here. Maybe I'd like to help contribute. I'm sure there are people listening who are thinking, yeah, I know a guy that killed my cousin or whatever it is, who might want to make sure that their people are counted in here. So how can they help?
Well, go to How to Help on fatalencounters.org. And actually, a lawyer in Texas got my records for all the state and local law enforcement agencies in Texas. There's like 1,900 of them, and he's doing public records requests of all of them. So we're going to have Texas will be a comprehensive state that we have.
Yeah. You know what I think is going to happen? And, for social science, I'm way ahead of what we got here. But I'm guessing that when this is, you know, more or less complete, that you can say, okay, look what we've done here. Now let's really start to go through and see what we can see. That this is just going to absolutely, it's not really going to be surprising, but it's going to be absolutely shocking to people. Just, you know, it'll be, you know, the word epidemic is going to be unavoidable here. And anybody with a Facebook feed can tell you that right now, you know?
Yeah, I think the numbers will shock people. I think they believe the FBI when the FBI says it's 400 a year. I think some of the other things are actually more shocking. For example, in Nevada, 9% of the homicides committed since 2000 were committed by police. That's a huge number.
Oh my God!
Up to maybe 30% of people killed by police are mentally ill. That's a huge number, and that all goes back to training. We'll also be able to do things like use the U.S. Census Bureau's zip code function to compare socioeconomic status of where people are killed, and I think the biggest thing we'll find that they have in common is that they were poor. You know, in the area where they're killed. I think we'll find that people are more likely to be killed. Well, obviously, we'll find that more likely to be killed in areas of high urban density.
Right.
Another thing I think we'll be able to do is check the names against the veterans list of vets, people who've served our country. And we'll find out a huge percentage of people who are killed by police are veterans.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're even trained specifically to be terrified of veterans, too. So that's probably a big part.
I think they are. But I also think that veterans, they have higher incidence of PTSD. They're also more experienced with guns, which is one of the things that cause police to shoot you. There's a lot of factors to it, and all that bears further analysis, but it can't be done until we have the numbers. That's the whole purpose of this thing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's like you're saying, what you're describing there is just a taste of what's possible, but we don't even know what's going to happen when all the civil rights lawyers are done digging through what you put together here. So,
right.
You know, may 10 million lawsuits bloom.
Probably not, actually. There's a couple people like Deadspin. Is doing one sort of like mine, except they're looking at particular incidents. I mean, I'm not interested in officers' names. for example. I'm not interested in the numbers of bullets that flew. I'm only interested in trends, so that you can look across the country and compare, say, Albuquerque, New Mexico to Reno, Nevada, or, you know, Reno to Boise, and see if one of them has a much higher rate of incidents per 100,000 people. But since I am working with Kyle over there, we're going to combine our two databases, our two spreadsheets into one, which will have all that information. So you'll be able to look at incidents and at trends before this is all over.
Right. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. So, you know, again, the possibilities are endless. I can't imagine what all different kinds of conclusions will be able to be drawn from the data. I mean, just the short list that you went down of things that you're beginning to glean from the Nevada numbers, that kind of stuff is just the very beginning. So,
right.
You know, I think this is a really important project that you're doing here, man.
A big part of what was going on in Ferguson is we don't really know what the race numbers are. Nobody tracks that. So anybody can say anything, you know, and nobody can contradict him and say, okay, this is the truth. We're finding that out. I mean, we already know more about it than has existed.
Mm-hmm. Well, women about Ferguson specifically. Can you talk about that?
No, I can't talk about. I haven't even focused on Ferguson. No. So no, I can't.
I see what you mean, though. It was basically a figure of speech there. I get you.
Yeah. For example, if all these other factors are equal, like people are in one zip code, mental illness is roughly equal across the genders, race is equal across, you know, across gender, all these other things remaining equal, why is it 96% of the people killed by police are men? It seems that, like, if mental illness is a big factor, then women would have to take in 15%, right?
Yeah.
Just logically. So there's all kinds of things that raise questions about how police interact with people who are mentally ill, because it suggests that they're less likely to kill a woman. And I, you know, anecdotally, I believe that. Well, I can see it in the numbers, actually. I believe that's true, and I think that's training. That's how they relate differently to women. You know, it's about how we perceive different people in different ways. And if we could modify that, or quantify it, or modify protocols or procedures to take that into account, fewer people will die.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I may be cynical, but it seems to me like the answer there is it's a lot harder to justify killing a woman. But you can say, oh, I was afraid he was coming at me and whatever, and it doesn't matter if he's dead. As long as he's a male, then that's a good enough excuse to shoot somebody, basically, for a cop.
That is almost always the reason that's given. I mean, the courts have recognized that as an acceptable reason. The officer was in fear for their life, and we know that that is probably, if it's absolutely true, an acceptable reason to shoot somebody, to defend yourself, right? But the courts have always accepted it.
It's supposed to be a reason, not an excuse to shoot somebody.
Exactly.
That's the point, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And there are protocols that define those reasons, and you know, I think how we perceive this will change once the real numbers are out there.
Yeah.
Or even a sizable sampling. I mean, I don't know if we got 20%. Is that going to be enough to draw conclusions from? I would say so. And we've already got all right. Just in the database, there's about 1,300. That means they've been kind of they've been gone through by the fact checkers and editors, so that's the best information we have. Then there's another level where people have submitted through the form, which is it doesn't go into the database until it's been fact checked and verified by editors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a real fact checking; it's a checking against either media accounts or public records, which is not the same as calling people, you know?
Right.
And then there's another level, a spreadsheet where people can do further research on subjects, and there's about 2,000 on that. And then I have about 3,000 more that haven't even been put on a spreadsheet yet. They're just in different, well, they're on multiple spreadsheets mostly. And so we're approaching 30%, right?
Yeah.
I think conclusions we'll be able to draw real conclusions by the end of the year.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you're making real progress too, huh? Got enough volunteers and all that.
It's the crowd. I mean, people have submitted from France. I mean, people all over the United States. People are doing visualizations of the data based on these early numbers we have. The spreadsheets are available to anyone who wants to help.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, just as long as people understand that this is very preliminary data, I love it. I think it's awesome.
I think, you know, part of it is the frustration, too, with the media, because, you know, take your average local TV news channel. I'm sure there are exceptions. But your average local TV news channel is going to always take the cops' side against the people every time. Seven on your side, where we justify what the cops just did to you. That's all it is. I mean, that's almost, they're like the government's ombudsman for the mayor's office or the local police department. And so people feel like, you know, God dang, people keep getting shot. They report the facts, but they never seem to recognize the pattern that is scaring the hell out of everybody else here. And so, you know, hopefully this will help break through some of that where, you know,
you got that exactly right. You got it exactly right. It's like local media are generally lapdogs to the government. It's they don't ever question these reasons of justification. It's like somebody smoked pot once, so they got busted for pot, so they're a criminal? Bullshit. It's just not right. You know, somebody is in a car with a knife. How is the officer in fear of their life for that? Or some 18-year-old kid is running away from an officer, no sign of a weapon, no sign of, you know, danger. Why is that kid get killed?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and how is it we live in a society where cops are all trained as though we have total Singapore levels of gun control around here, and that anybody with a gun must therefore be a criminal trying to use it on you, when in fact there are hundreds of millions of legally owned firearms by law-abiding private citizens in this country. But now all of a sudden, you know, you got a number 10 on the threat matrix because you own a Glock.
Right.
It's totally crazy.
Right. It's legal behavior is considered justification for killing. I don't know how to say it any clearer than that.
Yeah.
It's like you see it all the time. Person had a gun. But lots of people carry guns, and you don't get to shoot them just because you don't like them.
Right.
There has to be more to it than that. There has to be.
All right. Well, listen, I think that, you know, when it comes to making a change, this is the kind of thing that can really help, you know, for people to be able to go and say, no, actually, it's not just an assumption. Here we've got the data that really shows that it's time for, you know, whatever state assembly to pass a bill that changes something around here because we're sick of it. You know, it's crazy what's going on here.
Well, I tend to agree. I mean, that's the whole purpose of the thing is to help the government do the right thing, if only by undermining their ability to lie.
Yeah, providing that intellectual ammo for the people who are taking them on. Well, listen, Brian, I thank you very much for the effort and for your time on the show today. I think it's just great. And good luck to you.
Oh, well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on.
All right, everybody. That is Brian Burkhardt. He's at FatalEncounters.org, and he's also the editor and publisher of the Reno News and Review in Reno, Nevada. So go and check out. It's a really great website. They got all the tools where you can help out as well. You can go through, review the data, learn what you can from it. Pass the link on to your activist friends. It's FallenEncounters.org. And as long as I got a couple of minutes left before this break, and we're on the subject of the police state, I just got a few to get out of the way for you here. This is New Jersey. This is so funny. You guys heard this one, right, where the cop is being recorded, and he starts threatening the guy recording him, and the guy tells him, "Hey, man, it's the Constitution, you know, protects my rights." And the cop says, "Well, I don't have to obey the Constitution, because if Barack Obama doesn't have to obey the Constitution, then I don't have to obey the Constitution." In other words, power flows from the barrel of a gun. Just don't walk toward me aggressively and I won't shoot you to death. Like they published that essay, in that op-ed in the Washington Post. Just don't walk toward me and I won't murder you. Wait, what? Is that the law? Anyway, he had to resign from his part-time job. It says here he was double-dipping, collecting a pension while retired from a different New Jersey police department. Oh, I'm so surprised to find out that this cop was actually a criminal. Oh, it's not stealing if you're the government, right? Oh, okay. That's why it's a crime for you to steal, actually. It's not because it's wrong, a violation of somebody else's property rights. It's because only the government has the right to do that, and they'll kill you if you try to act like them. Anyway, so now the local town council is trying to pass a law banning photography and video recording inside government buildings. What? You recorded a police officer in this jurisdiction announcing his absolute defiance and a rejection of his own oath of office to the rule of law, and embarrassed him right out of here. Made a national news story out of it. Well, we're just going to make it illegal then for you to film inside a building. Are these people kidding me? I kind of like stories like this because it comes right up against, never mind my libertarian view of how things are supposed to be or anything, but just what, you know, everybody's mom believes about what's supposed to be going on around here, you know? Like, yeah, you get a fair trial, like on Matlock, you know? You get to contradict the people saying bad stuff about you, right? You know, just kind of basic understandings about how things are supposed to be. Hey, wait a minute. Is that really right? They can ban us recording them? I mean, are they public servants at all? Or is that absolutely and entirely a lie? They are simply our overlords and we are their slaves. Is that how it works? Because under what theory of popular sovereignty where free men institute a government to protect their lives and liberty, do the local pigs have the authority to tell you to turn off your damn cell phone camera? Who could have possibly imagined that? Oh, here's a couple of guys been in prison since 1983. Read about it in the New York Times, how the cops knew that the rapist murderer lived in the neighborhood, was right there, but they decided they wanted to convict these guys anyway. Oh, and this stuff is too good. I'm going to have to tell you after the break. Just wait. ScottHorton.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. So Joe Biden says he will follow Omar Baku al-Baghdadi to the gates of hell. Huh? You know, John McCain said that same thing about Osama bin Laden back in the campaign of 2007 and 80s. I'll follow Osama bin Laden to the gates of hell, he said. Excuse me, guys. That figure of speech means that that person is your leader. And you will do anything they say. Anything. Sarge, I'll follow you to the gates of hell. That means go ahead and lead me into battle. I trust you. You're my man. You're my leader. Yeah, let's do it. That's what it means. I subordinate my will to yours in battle, sir, because you are the commander of our brigade. I will follow you to the gates of hell. That's what that means. What are you, an idiot? You stupid idiot Vice President of the United States, you will follow Baghdadi to the gates of hell? Why don't you just say, yeah, we would like to see the guy killed and we're working on that? You gotta talk like a tough guy and you get it all confused because you're stupid and evil. So, whatever, big surprise. And I know, it's just stupid. I don't mean to waste time on it, but what are you talking about, Vice President of the United States, Biden? Idiot. All right, now, I'm sorry. I should have given this more time, so I'm giving it more time now. From the New York Times. DNA evidence clears two men in 1983 murder. And what it says here is that these two North Carolina young black men at the time, now they're old. They were, this guy, according to the, you know, I don't know exactly what this means, and I don't know if you do or if anybody does, but they're saying now, according to the testimony, this guy has the mental abilities of a 9-year-old. And they went ahead and convicted him for the rape and the murder of an 11-year-old girl in 1983. The case was completely weak all along. The DNA evidence, get this, implicates another man whose possible involvement had been somehow overlooked by the authorities, even though he lived only a block from where the victim's body was found, and he had admitted to committing a similar rape and murder around the same time. Pardon me. I hate to admit it. You know, I mean, I really think probably before thinking, well, they were all, you know, the cops and the murderer were all in the same KKK group together or something. Actually, you know, I wonder if it was just two different detectives. And the one detective wanted to go ahead and have this case, and so he didn't want to pin it on the same guy as the other detective had that guy's case, because then he'd have to give him the case. Ha! I mean, I'm just using my imagination, but I'm pretty intuitive about stuff like that, and I bet you that's what was going on there. And does anybody care that the guy who raped and murdered an 11-year-old girl got to get away with it? Got to get away with it. While two innocent men who are mental children, who can't even think like an adult to even understand, you know, and put in context properly the unfairness and the injustice that they're suffering. Can you imagine? Who do you remember at all who you were when you were 9? Locked in prison for 20 years because the pigs don't care. They don't care if they get the right guy or not. It's an adversarial system, man. They just gotta win. It doesn't matter whether it's the truth. It's all about that conviction rate. Whoever the cops bring you, you put them in prison. That's the rule. That's what it means to be a district attorney. Seek justice. Don't lie to me. Your lies don't work on me. They don't care at all what happened to these two men. They don't care at all. And then they even got the quote here from Scalia, saying, I don't know exactly in what context, but screw them because of what they did, no matter what kind of mental child he is. What he did was so horrible that it's hard to argue against lethal injection. Yeah, except that he didn't do it. But meanwhile, Harry A. Blackmun, in a dissent, noted that Mr. McCollum, oh, and they've said this not just recently, but all along. This is from back in the, this is from 94. 10 years after the fact or so. Harry A. Blackmun, in a dissent, noted that Mr. McCollum had the mental age of a 9-year-old and that, quote, this factor alone persuades me that the death penalty in this case is unconstitutional. Well, no, they sat on death row. He lost. That was a failing dissent. He lost. These guys were on death row until someone intervened. The Center for Death Penalty Litigation, a nonprofit legal group in North Carolina. Hey, kids, grow up to be someone who sues the government, okay? That's what it means to be noble. To stick up for people who have no power at all. And so anyway, these guys said, no, we want DNA. you know, good enough for these 12 idiots to condemn to death is not good enough, is not beyond a reasonable doubt. Good enough for us. Show me the science. So now that they're in their 50s, these two guys would be out. Of course, there was a confess that was tortured out of them, basically. They were threatened into confessing. It doesn't, you know, you are getting the death penalty. The only way to not, for us to not put the needle in your arm, they bellowed in his face, is to admit you did it right now. Then you'll only get life. That's how they do it. Torture does work. If you're trying to get someone to say whatever it is that you want them to say, just like Al Libby pretending that Osama's anti-terrorist Saddam Hussein's anti-terrorist training camp in Iraq, where his Mukhbarat police practiced raiding an airplane fuselage to kill terrorists.
You want me to say that that's where he trained Al-Qaeda? Yeah, I was there, said Sheikh Al-Libi under duress.
Same thing with false confessions in local police departments all across this country. And you'd be amazed to find out, if you just took freshman psychology class, how quickly people break. Put them in a small interrogation room with a hot light and a big, fat, stinky-breathed pig screaming in their face about how they're going to get the death penalty, and people will admit to anything. You don't even have to lay a hand on them. You don't have to give them the Jose Padilla MK Ultra no-touch torture treatment. All you got to do is just scream in their face, "We know you did it. We're going to give you the death penalty," over and over about 10 times, and they'll sign anything you say. And the cops know that, and they do it all the time, and they don't care if the guy that raped and murdered the 11-year-old girl gets away with it. What do they care? In fact, you've probably heard of this and wondered about this your whole life, just like me too. My whole life, I've heard of people who were falsely, obviously, falsely convicted of killing a cop. You know, from like Unsolved Mysteries with Robert Stack or whatever. A million of them, my whole life long. I hear just one recently, I can't remember the details, but just last week or 2 weeks ago, there was one about someone falsely convicted of killing a cop. What does that mean? That means they're willing, they don't care. They'll let someone get away with killing a cop if they get to pin it on the guy that they hate and want to pin it on. Because what a great thing to pin on someone, man. Now, who are these people? They're crazy. They're our security force? I don't understand how anybody decided that, yeah, I know, Scott, but this is the best we can do. You know, this is as close to freedom we can get, is we hire every community's worst, most pathological, psychopathic murderers to be our security force, and then hopefully by giving them a bunch of responsibilities, they'll take good care of us all. What? Really? They will, huh? Yeah, unless you're this poor, retarded black man in, where are they at again? In North Carolina, in which case, no, you'll just go to death row and spend your whole life there, even though you never did nothing to nobody. They don't care. They don't care. They never did care. And they never will care.
This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State: The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audio book of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Ramsey Baruth's coming on to talk about Palestine here in a while. So hang around for that. It was funny, I was talking about that death penalty case. I just saw someone else tweeted the part I'd miss. The man's IQ was 51. Innocent man sitting on death row. They say mental age of a 9-year-old, exactly what that means. Exactly what IQ of 51 means. Yeah, you can't quantify intelligence. I mean, I guess you can try, but anyway. Point is, the guy, no offense, was some kind of stupid idiot that couldn't possibly have been even fit to stand trial as an adult for this crime in the first place, it doesn't sound like. But then, of course, he didn't do it at all. And the guy that did it lived a block from where they found the body and had just confessed to a crime just like that against another person, according to the New York Times. How in the world did the cops ever overlook it? And anyway, so then my friend Jimmy emailed me and said, I got an idea. How about then, you know, the prosecutor's got to do the time that the wrongfully convicted had to do. Hey, sounds great to me, except you know what would happen? They would just outlaw appeals. There would never be any accountability again. I can hear him now. Well, you know, finality is really important. Why are we wasting so much time on appeals for convicted murderers, after all? Convicted criminals. They won't let there be accountability. We're better off letting them get away with it than suffering the blowback of trying to hold them accountable, because they'll just find another way around, like no one ever gets to second guess them again. I'm telling you, man. The whole just assumed and presumed legitimacy of the state. Yeah, it's really time for all of you to go ahead and call it into question. You know? I love telling this anecdote. Back when I was a cab driver, I was driving around a lady going to some meetings downtown one day, and she was an assistant district attorney from Houston, Harris County, death penalty capital of the world. And I think they're in first place, and then America, and then China, something like that. Down there in Houston, boy, they just kill people a lot. And anyway, she said, and of course, no, not her, but everybody else at the local district attorney's office, their slogan, I couldn't have made this up. I didn't see this on TV. There's no other place for me to get it. I mean, this is, you can't make this stuff up. She told me, assistant DA, prosecutor in Harris County, Texas, told me their slogan down at the office is, if they really didn't do it, they'll get out on appeal. In other words, I don't give an F at all whether these people are guilty. It's not even my job to decide whether I really think they did it. My only job is to see if I can get it past a grand jury and then a petit jury and see as much time or death penalty or extreme sentence as possible put on to them. And then, hey, it's on them if they want to get out of it. They really didn't do it. And notice, the theory isn't, if they really didn't do it, they'll win the trial and be acquitted. No, they don't believe that. They don't even lie and tell themselves that. If they really didn't do it, they'll get out on appeal. But of course, once you're already convicted, the entire burden of proof of the appeal is on you. 2/3 burden of proof on you. How do you quantify that? Nobody knows. It's just nonsense. But it's to make it very difficult. And then you have to prove there was something wrong with your trial. Not that you actually didn't do it. Not even necessarily that, yeah, now there's new evidence. But you have to prove that the judge, the prior judge and prosecutor broke the rules in the way that they convicted you. Otherwise, it doesn't matter whether you actually did it or not. What matters is you've been found guilty. And as they already say, again, I couldn't make this stuff up. You couldn't make this stuff up. This is their words. Oh, finality is important. We have to make sure that, after all, if every decision by every court can be endlessly questioned, then why even have judges at all? Oh, no. They'd have to all go get real jobs. And so, yeah, I mean, these people, they are basically gigantic carnivorous monsters trying to kill you. I mean, what can I tell you? The government of your town, your county, your state, your government, your country is trying to kill you and take all your stuff from you. I mean, they'll kill you if they have to. They'll do whatever they want with you. They'll do whatever they want with you. They don't care if you're the one who raped and killed the young girl at all. They don't care if the person who did it gets away with it at all. All they care about is convicting the person that they feel like convicting for whatever reason belongs to them alone. That's all. That could just as well be your son. That they say, hey, let's convict him of raping and murdering a little girl. Well, what do we care if he did it or not? What do we care if the guy who really did it gets away with it or not? Meh. Off they go. Read it and weep. It's in the New York Times today, okay? That's not a right-wing or left-wing or libertarian radical opinion of mine. It's in today's New York Times. They don't care whether you did it or not. They'll do whatever they want. They are your enemies. Stop loving them. Stop believing in them. Stop demanding what they have in supply. Violence, aggression, dishonesty. Get over it. I don't know how anybody could be anything but an absolute anarchist at this point, right now. Private property only. There is no public property, so you're trespassing. Beat it. Who in the world hired the government, especially in this country, to be our security force? I mean, who is believing in this anymore? Here from boingboing.com, here's your security force for you. Fake phone attacking cell towers are all across America. Yeah, they've got some awesome new anonymity apps for your Android phone that'll tell you if some signal is trying to hijack your phone and switch it to 2 or 3G and hack you and get in and steal all your stuff and record all your calls and what have you. And they're everywhere. As soon as the people came out with the app, they started driving around and all over the place. You know it's the government. It's the government that's doing it. Or at least it's the private industry doing it at the behest of government. They have fake, information less. They don't respond back who and what they are and what they're doing. But just these cell towers out hacking into people's cell phones all over the country now. All over the country. Look, again, you couldn't make this stuff up, right? Oh, come on, Scott Wharton. Is that really right? Well, that's what it says. So Cory Doctorow, who is a real-ass journalist over here at boingboing.com, he's broken a lot of important stories. I've never heard anyone say anything bad about his journalism ever. Fake phone-attacking cell towers are all across America, reads the headline. Your security force. And then here is our good friend Trevor Tim in The Guardian. Homeland Security was built to fend off terrorists, which of course isn't really true, but anyway. Why is it so busy arming cops to fight average Americans? His 1033 program, not to be confused with the 12333 program, which is spying on you. The 1033 program, whereby the Pentagon gives all the weapons from the last few occupations to the local police for use against you. That's just a small part of it. Homeland Security is responsible for the vast bulk of the distribution of all of these weapons and all this ammunition and all these armored vehicles and drones and all their spying technology, too. It is so far out of control, and there's no accounting on it whatsoever. And I think you'll really like this article and want to pass it around. Again, it's Trevor Tim at The Guardian. Homeland Security was built to fend off terrorists. And again, not really true, but, you know, the British are the worst headline writers ever. It's not Trevor's fault. It's the Guardian people wrote this headline for him, and so he's stuck with it, the poor guy. But anyway, man, is it full of links to proof for his evidence, at least, for his assertions about what is going on here. But he just paints a really scary picture of how far it's gone. Just to let you know, I mean, really, what are we talking about here? The extent, the lengths to which they've gone to, in effect, nationalize local police in this country. And it's not a clear chain of command. It ain't quite yet. As we talked about on the show last week, almost unbelievably, but unfortunately not, a bunch of liberal groups, including even the ACLU. I mean, no surprise from the unions. The ACLU signed on to the idea of putting a police czar, an unelected police czar in the Department of Justice to oversee every last police department in America to make sure they're protecting all of our civil rights and this and that, this and that. And this is just not how American federalism is supposed to work at all, at all. I mean, this is so far past constitutionalism in America, it's almost unbelievable that anyone would pretend that we still have the Constitution of 1789 in effect at all at this point, that they would even try that. When the federal government's jurisdiction on criminal law constitutionally is basically against counterfeiting and acts of treason and negotiating with foreign states without permission.
you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, you know...
Or he'll say, look, even...
What the hell is that playing? Oh, no. I'm never going to find whatever the hell that was. Is it this? No. Damn. I don't have a page from the International Business Times open, do I? I hate those guys and their damn auto-playing ads. Well, crap. I have no idea which tab is playing audio, so... I can't use this computer to play the audio I wanted to play you. That ain't bothering me. Well, anyway... it was an ad. It was the new ad that I did for Livin' La Vida Baroka. And I don't really know exactly what that means. But I understand what Baroque means now. And the title refers to that. Yeah, I'm kind of dumb. It's all right. The book is Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in a Time of Imperial Orthodoxies. Well, so the thing about that is it's Thomas Harrington, a guy who often writes for antiwar.com, writes good stuff for antiwar.com and for Counterpunch. And it's a great little book full of essays, and I want you to buy it. Livin' La Vida Baroka. And hopefully I'll have final approval on this ad that I cut, and it'll start airing on the show tomorrow. And speaking of which, this show is also sponsored by Pizza Noir, Book 1. By Denver Day, which is a fun little read. And then also, of course, Mike Swanson, Wall Street Window and the War State, the Future Freedom Foundation, the Council for the National Interest, LibertyStickers.com, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc., and Darren's Coffee, man. You got to drink Darren's Coffee. That's at Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. And then, of course, there is My Heroes Think, busts of Ron Paul and Murray Rothbard and Harry Brown for sale there at myheroesthink.com. Listen and Think Audio. They do libertarian audio books that you might be interested in there. And soon again, I believe, and I sure do hope, and I'm pretty sure that soon again it'll be Express Coin. It was cashintocoins.com, and now it's Express Coin. You may know they sponsor Mark and Ian on Free Talk Live. Hope to be bringing them back on here real soon, too. So please, for God's sake, man, support my sponsors, the sponsors that support this show. In fact, go to scotthorton.org/sponsors. And you can find links to them all, and you can help support the two new books I just mentioned there. They're both right at the top of the page at scotthorton.org/books if you want to buy those books. Also, Mike Swanson's book is in there, too. Yeah, all right. Doing a little business here. That's how we do business. Okay. Now, man, I got to change the subject to, I'm not even sure which. I guess I could go, well, you know what? Let me make sure that I said everything that absolutely needs to be covered today about Ukraine. Again, I mean, this is the top headline, other than all the great stuff that Jack Matlock, boy, I kind of got him riled up, man. All the great stuff that he said, that people could write news stories about, all the stuff he said on the show today. But this is another very important news story today. Lech Walesa, who was the leader of Solidarity, whose protests against communist rule in Poland helped lead to the dissolution of the Soviet Union, a major part of that story, and then he became... a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, the real kind, though, not like Henry Kissinger or Barack Obama or other war criminals like that. And he was the president, I believe, or prime minister, yeah, president of Poland. And he has said arming Ukraine could lead to nuclear war. He's saying what apparently is, you know, the phrase that you just can't say out loud in D.C., that, like, guys, you can really only mess with the Russians so much. I mean, I understand everybody's having fun, and a lot of people are having attention paid to them, which is really important for them. Okay. However, we're talking about Russia here, and they've got H-bombs, and so back down. That's it. What are you doing? The Cold War is over. It's supposed to be. Now they're talking about a rapid reaction force and NATO training inside Ukraine. This could lead to a war with Russia. Are you digging it? They're way, way, way over the line here. And if they would just say, listen, you know what? You can have a trade deal with Russia and the EU. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. And listen, we have no intention of bringing Ukraine into NATO. Come on, we're not going to do that. So now, come on, everybody get along, blah, blah, blah. That could be the start of a brand new day there. But no, ever since Bush, they have said over and over again that, yeah, eventually we're bringing NATO all the way to Russia's border there, to Russia's border with the Luhansk region. What? Well, as the ambassador said, no, no, no. Their red line is that they will never let you do that. They're not going to allow that. And flip the story around the other way. I mean, imagine for a minute, it's basically unimaginable. It's so completely ridiculous, it's unimaginable, right? That the Russians would do a coup d'etat and use Nazis even to overthrow the government in Canada and install a pro-Russian regime there and then would launch a war against British Columbia for refusing to accept their rule. America would nuke all of Russia. That's it. Simple as that. Probably if it was President Kucinich or Paul, they would nuke Russia over that. And in fact, let's be more specific. Why is that not even the slightest possibility in a million years? Because the Russians would never try that in a million years. Because we would nuke them off the face of the earth, and they know it. That is what we're doing. Ukraine is their Canada. That's it. That's the closest metaphor you could get to their relationship with this state next door. And I'm not saying that's right, that there even is a government in Russia. I'm just saying this is the world we're living in, and this is the fire that they are knowingly playing with. And it's madness. You put the shoe on the other foot for an instant, and you say, no, this has got to stop immediately. This has absolutely got to stop. What are they doing? Obama says NATO must help strengthen Ukraine's military. In what universe? U.S. President John McCain urged NATO on Wednesday to help strengthen Ukraine's military and said the alliance must leave the door open to new members to counter what he called Russian aggression. McCain was speaking in Estonia. I'm sorry, I get these two confused. They all look alike to me. You understand these presidents, these senators. This is crazy. I don't know what else to tell you. I'm complaining because, it shouldn't be this way. What are we talking about here? I mean, the good news is that Putin wants peace and is working on it. And he's kind of announcing, maybe he's getting a little bit ahead of the game. He's working on a ceasefire deal with the president. The prime minister then comes out and tries to undermine it over there. But, so I guess we'll see what happens here. That's just crazy. You know, I got in a debate with a neocon. I got into a debate. I was in a debate with a neocon at the University of at Texas A&M in 2008. And he was talking about how America's not an empire at all. What are you talking about? But this was right after the war in Georgia. And I says, oh, I shouldn't quote myself like this. It sounds bad. But anyway, I didn't want to recycle the joke and pretend that it was original or anything. But I says, oh, yeah, no, we have a border dispute with Russia right now in the Caucasus Mountains. But we're not an empire. Yeah, our border dispute with Russia, it's not in Alaska. It's not the new Russian-backed government of Mexico. We are over there meddling in the Caucasus Mountains that even most college students at A&M or UT or otherwise couldn't find on a map. It's madness. It's crazy. And then look at this. Even at the Kiev Post, they're letting you pass the paywall on this one.
Azov Battalion fighters pledged to defend Mariupol. They're Nazis. They call themselves social nationalists in this freaking article. I swear to God. KievPost.com.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. And listen, I did have some good news, some other good news about Ukraine. Other than, you know, Putin doing a trial balloon about saying, yeah, we're working on a ceasefire here. I don't know. But check this out. Russian bank, and not just any bank, but the Gazprom bank, has just hired former senators John Bro, I don't know who he is, and Trent Lott to be lobbyists. Oh, thank God. That is probably the best move that Vladimir Putin has made this whole time. Vladimir Putin just hired the former majority leader of the U.S. Senate. The former Republican leader of the U.S. Senate. I mean, this is better than important zillion-dollar business ties. This is the government hiring a corrupt former majority leader of the U.S. Senate to represent their interests in Washington, D.C. This could be an important, you know, piece, important channel for peace. How about that? I was going to say a piece of a something toward peace, but then, you know, I'm not that good at talking. But you understand what I'm trying to say. This is the best news we've got. Let's get Trent Lott up on the Hill right now saying, hey, everybody cool out. I'm getting paid here. Because they respect that up there on Capitol Hill. Oh, the Russians are paying you, Trent Lott? Gee, you got me paid a bunch of money back when, I guess. Okay. You know? You get it? That way, you know, to help prevent war. I mean, worse war than the one that America has been helping and encouraging the Kiev Nazi-backed coup d'etat junta to wage on the east these last couple of months here. And by the way, has anyone ever heard of a group of liars as bad at lying as the government of Kiev? I mean, they make Richard Pearl look like the epitome of honesty and clarity. And what are they talking about? Every single thing that they say every day is a lie. Thousands of Russian troops are pouring over the border, huh? Oh, you eliminated their entire convoy, their armored convoy with artillery. You did, huh? Show us the smoldering wreckage. Oh, there's none at all because he just made that up? Oh, okay. Can you show us any pictures of these marauding? No, Reason Magazine is over there buying into. No, it's a stealth invasion, you see. Yes, they're literally tens of kind of off-duty Maoist, quote-unquote, volunteers going over there to help out a little bit. Yeah, some invasion, huh? What a giant invasion. Day after day, they claim these things. Never does it pan out. And then I just saw this headline, and I'm not, you know, 100% conclusive on this thing or anything, but I just thought this was funny, that the Russians are demanding LibertyCrier.com today, LibertyCrier.com. Russia demands publication of recordings from downed flight MH17. The Brits got the black boxes. The Russians are saying, give us the black boxes, man. Boeing catastrophe throws up more and more questions, he says. You know, I was thinking the same thing. No, I saw this headline and I thought, those dastardly Russians. What are they hiding? You can tell they're hiding the truth because they're the ones demanding that the black boxes be released. And yet, I don't know who's still arguing about this, but I'm pretty sure it's no longer in dispute that there were Kiev regime fighter jets in the air that day. And that it's
probably at least 51%, maybe much better, likely that they're the ones who shot that plane down. They got all these satellite photos of a few artillery pieces in a field somewhere. Show us the pictures of the missile that shot down the plane then. And telling me the USA doesn't have satellite, photography over the Ukraine-Russia border this entire time? Since at least New Year's? You know, come on. It's the dog that didn't bark big time there. Where's all America's proof of all of John Kerry's loudmouthed assertions? Oh, nowhere, huh? Here are the Russians demanding evidence. Why? To implicate the rebels that they're backing? I'm thinking maybe probably not. Well, I am kind of obnoxious, aren't I? Sorry about that. I'm kind of burnt out, man. I've been going through this crap for so long. I'm over it. I'm over it, and yet I'm still at it. So, yeah, sorry for being so cranky. The good news is I'm going to be interviewing Ramsey Baroud. You get to hear his substantive remarks on the situation in Gaza coming up here soon. So, I'll save everything about Gaza I have here, Israel, until then. But here's some ISIS news. There's a reporter I'm trying to reach. He's a former Iraq War veteran named Ford Cipher. Here he is writing at the Daily Beast. Are American troops already fighting on the front lines in Iraq? The Pentagon is denying that U.S. troops are fighting ISIS on the ground in Iraq, but eyewitness accounts and Kurdish officials tell a different story. And, of course, there were reports in the British press last week or 2 weeks ago that SAS and Delta Navy SEALs were on the ground there. Our friend Mitchell Prothero from McClatchy Newspapers reported back in early July that they were building up the quote-unquote secret, because it's not really secret, CIA base, former Air Force base there. I believe it was Air Force, former Army base of some kind, there in Kurdistan, that they're putting it back together again, and that CIA, JSOC, and SOCOM were there. That's, Army Rangers as well as Delta and Navy SEAL top tier guys, and they change their names all the time, the Combat Applications Group and whatever the hell, who can keep track, but it's the same damn thing. The top tier special forces and the spies there building up flying drones, building up their base there, and that was 2 months ago. Okay, so and of course, you know, to really be accurate with the air power, I don't know what all technology they have, but a lot of it depends on men on the ground with laser pointers guiding the missiles to their targets. So that requires special ops troops, or at least, you know, Peshmerga that could be relied on, that kind of thing to help with. And then somewhere in here, yeah, Germany. Kurdish officials also told the Daily Beast they would be utilizing weapons that have been flown in from countries including the U.S. and Germany during the offensive. I think they said something about... Didn't they say something about German guys on the ground? I didn't have time to read this thing carefully before the show, I'm afraid. I spent too much time trying to track down contact information for this guy. According to Kurdish sources, U.S. Talk about burying the lead. According to the Kurdish sources, U.S. and German special operations teams had taken up positions in Zumar that allowed them to coordinate with U.S. aircraft. There you go. Blam. All right, so that's at the Daily Beast today. U.S. ground war has already begun. Call it a rolling start. Option B, if you can't just build up in Kuwait and completely reinvade first. Bad times. Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com has a piece you should look at. U.S. air war comp, because ISIS blends in with locals. Take off their black masks and get out of their Toyotas, and now how are you going to kill them from the air? Do like John Podhoretz said and just kill all Sunni fighting age males, right? Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. We're on Liberty Radio Network and ScottHorton.org. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. And our next guest on the show today is Ramzi Baroud. And he's the editor of Palestine Chronicle at PalestineChronicle.com. We often feature what he writes at antiwar.com, at original.antiwar.com/Ramzi-Baroud, and also sometimes on the blog as well. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Ramzi?
I'm doing well, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you back on the show here. And there's a whole hell of a lot to talk about, that's for sure. The first thing I'd like to say to introduce the topic, to get you started is I've been seeing on Twitter, I've been following more and more Gazans on Twitter because of the last war against them anyway. And so I've seen kind of firsthand these just kind of enormous, very joyous statements of celebration over the slightest lifting of the siege. Now they can go from 3 miles all the way to 6 miles off their coast without getting exploded to death in order to fish. And they're so thrilled. And I just thought, you know, in a pity kind of way, how sad and pathetic it is that this is what the people of the Gaza Strip are reduced to, is having to celebrate the slightest relaxation of the terms of their collective prison sentence that they're all life prison sentence they're all serving there. And in some cases, death sentence they're serving. So anyway, I was just hoping that, you know, you could talk to us a little bit about, you know, now that the ceasefire is holding, what do we know of the aftermath of, you know, what Israel has just done to the people of the Gaza Strip?
We'll do that. But first, let me just even so very briefly just explain why Gazans celebrated. This is their own decision, you know, to go to the streets in the hundreds of thousands and to celebrate while still, you know, the economy, there's no economy in Gaza. I mean, at this point, we're looking at 40,000 homes that were either completely destroyed or partly damaged. 75 UN schools that have been blown up, many hospitals, numerous mosques and churches, and so forth and so on. So you're looking, and this is a place, I mean, it's important that we remember that Gaza did not start or did not go into this war in any kind of, you know, shape of an economically sustainable shape to begin with. The UN few months ago came up with this report saying that Gaza will not be inhabitable by the year 2020, and its water will not be drinkable, you know, a couple of years before that, in fact. So they already, went into this war in a completely devastated state of economy and everything. But the reason that they've celebrated, it requires that we kind of really understand the psyche of the people in Gaza. And you know, my last book, I'm not trying to really plug it in here, but really just trying to understand,
sure,
you know, the spirit of the people of Gaza, which is, you know, to understand Gaza, it's different from understanding any other part of Palestine or the Middle East, because it's basically a small, tiny stretch of land that is surrounded mostly by Israel, but also blocked by Egypt and by the Israeli Navy at the Mediterranean Sea. So it's completely locked, and it has been living this kind of successive state of siege way before Hamas was even accepted in the Gaza Strip. Mm-hmm. And this kind of perpetual suffering, starting 1948, when Israel was established, 200,000 refugees found themselves in Gaza, competing for the meager resources and the tiny little land with the original inhabitants of the Gaza Strip. A lot of tension rose then. Somehow they managed to survive together. They were under successive wars, 1948, 1956, 1967, and so forth and so on. Yet not one single time in their history of these tormented people did they actually manage to hold the Israeli army at bay. Because we are talking about kind of ragtag militias, you know, young kids from refugee camps, you know, making their own weapons, fighting the Israeli tanks, shooting at Israel. And it's been a joke. It's been an absolute joke, the way that they have been fighting. Yet somehow they persisted. The you know, they would not accept defeat, even though any military strategist would look there and look the fourth strongest army in the world fighting these poor refugees who are lost in this desperate state of economy and state of affairs. And what are you guys fighting about? This, I mean, it's ridiculous. Why can't you just submit? And maybe after declaring your defeat, you will be rewarded with something. You would be able to survive or feed your kids. Why are you still thinking that you have the chance of winning? And imagine, after all of this, they actually managed to mature as people training in refugee camps, tunnels, underground, and they are able to cause the Israeli army, 64 soldiers, 600 wounded soldiers, destroying tanks, shooting down drones, to the extent that the Israeli army could not go beyond half a kilometer in the entire Gaza Strip. Netanyahu's plans militarily were a complete disaster. The Haaretz, even the Israeli public, the majority of them saying, we lost, Gaza won. And imagine this in the minds of this fourth, fifth generation of Gazans who are so used to defeat, so used to humiliation. The Israelis come in, occupy, destroy, kill, rape, imprison, capture, does whatever, and then they would go back declaring victory. Yet for the first time in their history, that did not happen. That's what they were celebrating. Not the ceasefire, not anything else.
Right, so it's not just a measure of their desperation and the fact that they got a few concessions as the terms of the ceasefire, but that they can feel proud that they're, you know, I guess if you can call Hamas and their armed wing defense forces, that they basically held tough and kept the Israelis from doing much worse. We are talking about, you know, as you said, a world power versus an occupied territory. So it's not like it's any kind of you know, level playing field or equal fight here, but I could see what you mean, that that feels like a real victory compared to what they were suffering.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's really something else. And then, okay, so in the couple minutes before the break, if you could please, sir, just try to break down a few of the numbers for us, casualties, amount of damage and infrastructure and that kind of thing.
2,143 Palestinians were killed, including 600 children, the vast majority, about 85 to 90% of whom are civilians. 11,500 plus were wounded. Many hospitals, of course, were targeted and destroyed. Schools, yet despite all of this, they are still going to change the way that the schools operate, and they will try to accommodate all the students. Hundreds of the students will not be going back to school because they were killed during the war. 20,000 homes were completely destroyed, an equal number that was damaged as well, and it cannot be inhabited. And of course, the economy right now has lost many billions of dollars that would require basically 1,000 trucks of aid and cement on a daily basis for the next 10 years in order for Gaza to be rebuilt.
Yeah, it's incredible. You know, if I mentioned this on the show yesterday, if people will just put into their favorite brand of search engine, aerial view, Gaza destruction, that's one of the features of this brave new era of drone wars, is that we have drone footage now of flying over Gaza, which will be enough in one instant to put the lie to any Israeli claim of using precision strikes on only Hamas targets and all the ridiculous things that they claim as they slaughter these people by the hundreds and thousands over there. Now, I'm sorry we have to stop and take this break, but we're talking with Ramzi Berood, editor of PalestineChronicle.com, and we'll have more about this entire mess when we get back. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Talking about the war against the Gazans here with Ramzi Baroud. Fearing political Islam, why Arabs betrayed Gaza is his latest piece at antiwar.com. There's a lot more than that. Here's a couple of headlines just for fun here on this topic. Israel confiscates nearly 1,000 acres of Palestinian land in the West Bank in the aftermath. I guess that's nothing compared to what they just did to the people of Gaza, right? So by dialectic rules, no big deal. And then here, Israel alarmed. This is the fun one. Israel alarmed by Al-Qaeda presence on the Syria border after they have worked all this time since 1996 to get the United States to regime change Bashar al-Assad in favor of chaos and madness. Now they're surprised that they've got al-Nusra suicide bomber kooks and the kidnapping peacekeepers in the Golan Heights. But anyway, so I'm sorry, when we were interrupted by the commercial break there, Ramsey, we were talking about the aftermath of the war in the Gaza Strip, the amount of casualties and that kind of thing. 600 children killed in this latest thing. And you talked about the people of Gaza's feelings of pride that they were able to withstand that assault, basically, strongly as they were able to. And they did win some concessions in the ceasefire. But so what do you think is the future now? Because there's really, it seems like the Israeli policy and the American policy is always going to be, well, Hamas equals ISIS, and so we can't deal with them, that kind of crap. And yet there doesn't seem to be any political opposition to Hamas in the Gaza Strip that can replace them anytime soon either. So I wonder what you think is going to happen from here. Is this the current status quo from here on out, or something big is going to move, or what?
Well, I think they have reached a conclusion, the various parties involved in this, Israel and Saudis and others, they've reached a conclusion that Hamas is not at its weakest. That was the argument. In fact, they went after Gaza thinking this is the most opportune time to get rid of Hamas forever, because, you know, supposedly it's the last leg on which the Muslim Brotherhood stands. If we get rid of Hamas, the whole Muslim Brotherhood phenomenon is gone and done with. And to their surprise, Hamas emerged much stronger and much more kind of validated within Palestinian political landscape, but also around the Middle East. So the plan really kind of fired back like you would never believe it. Now, Netanyahu is really caught in this situation where, so if I can't use Gaza as my, you know, field for experimentation, whether new weapons supplied by the U.S. or new political ideas to, you know, kind of push my ratings up, because, you know, they love to go to Gaza and say we are targeting terrorism, and suddenly they become heroes among their constituents back in Israel. If that is no longer an easy option, because he knows if he's going to go back to Gaza at any moment and fire one single rocket, one single missile, the war is going to start all over again. And if he could not deal with Gaza over the course of 51 days, he can't possibly be able to contain Gaza anymore. So what do you do? On one hand, he knows that the Gaza chapter is not closed. On the other, he's not going to be poking into Gaza anytime soon. That's why, back to that headline you just read, the thousand dunams that he, or acres that he is confiscating, you know, just like that, or privately owned land
on the West Bank.
In the West Bank, it's his message to the very, very angry Israelis who are saying, you humiliated us. You went to this war to get rid of Hamas and to create quiet for us in the southern border, and you came back with nothing, but now there's going to be 1,000 legal case against possible war criminals in the Israeli army. So what have you done? So he is fighting at three different fronts right now. Number one, he is creating this thing where he's trying to appease the settlers and to distract from the actual defeat that just happened in Gaza. Now that attention is, the Americans are not happy about it. Why create this situation, Netanyahu? We really did not need it in the first place. The Europeans are not happy. And now Netanyahu is hoping he is going to be once more seen seen as the defender of the settlers in the West Bank. And perhaps that is going to help him gain 1 or 2 points of the 60 points that he've lost in the 51-day Gaza war. Number two, he is back to Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, this kind of Vichy kind of government that is just basically doing exactly what Abbas wants them to do. Oh, you talk to Hamas, you are not a peace partner. Here's your ultimatum, Abbas. Abbas is an 80-year-old man who has no control over nothing. Another way to create this unnecessary fight in order for him to create distraction. And number three, and that's even more interesting, is his statement. He said a couple of days ago, he said, I could have went to war against Hamas and Gaza, not just for 50 days, but for 500 days. The reason I didn't, and I had to agree to the ceasefire, because ISIS was on my border. Okay, just really try to imagine that logic. How many Israelis did ISIS kill or hurt? How many times did ISIS try to infiltrate into the Israeli borders or target any Israeli interest in Palestine, in Israel, or anywhere around the world? Nil. Zero. Now, he's trying to create this menace that I am too being a victim of ISIS, and to divert attention and play on the fear element that the ISIS is just going randomly and chopping heads. Again, once more, hoping to create similarities between Hamas and ISIS and to present Israel as the victimized state and to explain why he pulled out or he had to end the Gaza war because he could not possibly achieve his military goal. This is very standard Netanyahu plan. I mean, we are so familiar with Netanyahu. He's been around for about 18 years, really, more or less. So we know the kind of tricks he's capable of pulling at any time. And that's just really typical Netanyahu's behavior.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then so, but what's Hamas to do? I mean, their alliance, this was one of the goals of the war, stated goals of the war, was to break the alliance somehow. Not that they ever really explained how this was supposed to work, I guess, but the alliance, the new coalition government between Hamas and Fatah, but it remains a coalition government for now, right?
It does, and I, you know, this has surprised even cynicals like myself. I really thought this is going to be it. Hamas, it's absolute strength right now. Why would they want to continue with this pathetic national unity deal with Mahmoud Abbas, who has nothing to offer? But you know what? When the war was over, a group of militants representing the various Palestinian factions, including the faction that belongs to Mahmoud Abbas, the Fatah Party, they went to the site of a massacre in a neighborhood called Shija'iyah, where the entire neighborhood was destroyed and hundreds of people were killed. And they stood on the ruins and they made a statement, a joint statement by all Palestinian factions, including Hamas and Fatah, where they insist that the Palestinian National Unity is a must, and no one, not Netanyahu or anyone else, will be able to defeat that initiative. And really, if that initiative did not fail, despite the attempted a 51-day war and all sorts of pressures, and yet the unity holds, it really does give a good and positive sign that perhaps this unity, this time around, is meant to hold.
Mm-hmm. And then, now I guess, I mean, maybe it's, I don't know. I don't have any faith that the Obama administration is going to send Kerry back to try again or any of that. It seems like, if anything, I don't know. I don't mean to be too definitive in my statement about it. Seems like to me that the war against Gaza was sort of Netanyahu's exclamation point on there never will be two states, not even the kind of rump state he's described in the past, so forget about it. But so where does that leave the future of their negotiations? I mean, they just go try to join more UN agencies until at some point they become treated like a state by enough of the other countries in the world that they somehow can try to declare independence? Or what do they do?
This is the aim of various Palestinian factions, including socialist movements and including Hamas. They basically tell Mahmoud Abbas, listen, dude, you've been doing this for a long time. You've aged while you are doing this, and you got nothing but embarrassment, defeat after defeat. And the West Bank is really like a Swiss cheese right now. It's just full of holes and Israeli settlements and bypass roads and all of that. Netanyahu is not, if Israel did not give you anything when it could have done something, would it give you something when they have the most right-wing government coalition in their history? It's just not going to happen now. So turn your back onto Israel, go to the ICC, go to various UN organizations, and let's just sort this out. Let's go back to the international community. And Hamas has actually been much more active in wanting to go to the international community than Abbas has. Abbas is hesitating for one simple reason. He needs American money in order for him to sustain his Palestinian Authority. Without American aid and European aid and Saudi aid, Abbas will not be able to politically justify his existence anymore. So he's delaying, he's playing games, but it seems to me that after the Gaza war, he understands that time has passed on that sort of behavior and delays, and that most likely he will end up going to the ICC. And then Netanyahu would once more declare, I have no partner in peace, thus I will go and build more settlements and so on.
But Ramsey, isn't it the case that right before the war, and this was really what caused the war, was Netanyahu's reaction to this coalition deal where Hamas had signed on to, they were kind of dropping the position that you just described in favor of Abbas and saying, okay, fine, we'll do it your way, even after the talks had already blown up. And now, but you're saying after the war, forget it.
Forget it. There can possibly be no talks at this point because Netanyahu understands that there is so much anger and frustration in the Israel. The Israelis just don't want a two-state solution. They just don't want it across the board. Aside from the remaining leftists, if you would even call them leftists, Israelis have divorced that idea. Practically, it can't happen either because Jewish settlements are scattered throughout the West Bank, taking over Jerusalem completely. There can be no way you can draw a line anymore and create a two-state scenario. But on the other hand, they are not prepared for one state either. So the options that are left to them, either permanent occupation and the occupation being the status quo, and by the way, this is not just a hypothesis, Netanyahu himself spoke about it. He said, I am prepared to offer you economic peace, meaning maintaining the occupation and actually maybe benefiting from it and giving the Palestinians few bites here and there. So they are happy. Palestinian elites are benefiting financially, and the Israelis can actually sustain the occupation and make it thrive to a degree. That's Netanyahu's offer. Nobody is talking about two states, one state. All of this, as far as Israel is concerned, is just over and done with. The Palestinians, on the other hand, Hamas on one hand is saying, listen, nothing but resistance would work with these guys. We've tried it in Gaza. We promise you this is how it's going to work. And Abbas is saying, no, that form of resistance is not going to work for us. But he is failing to actually take any meaningful political moves in order for him to actually present Palestinians with an alternative. And I think if he continued to do this, eventually there is going to be no taker among Palestinians that would believe in Mahmoud Abbas or his Palestinian Authority.
Yeah. All right, well, we're already over time, but thank you so much for your time. It's great to talk to you again, Ramsey. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott. You take care.
All right, y'all. That's Ramsey Baroud. He is the editor of Palestine Chronicle, and his latest book is My Father Was a Freedom Fighter. You can find at Amazon.com. Gaza's Untold Story is the subline there. And you can find his archive at antiwar.com.